really shielding, it gives you a shielding effect. But I think it's more of a short circuit is what's going on. And I've got a related question with a reference to a superconducting magnet. But let me ask you this one first. Go ahead, Alan. I mean, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
It really isn't a short circuit, Vic, because if you look at it, the best way to describe how it's working is high permeability material. It's the same as the core in a transformer. It's just with a big air gap in between. In other words, you've got the magnetic source at one point, and along the outside end, you've got another piece of magnetic material. It doesn't short it out. There's no resistance. All it does is when it hits something with high permeability, all of the lines of flux tuck together, and then they come out again on the other side. But all of those lines of flux return back to the magnet. So nothing is absorbed, nothing is lost. There's no heat involved. KC2QIQ, thus no resistance.
I didn't mean resistance. When I said short circuit, I said magnetic short circuit. I'm not talking about current flow. Now, you get the same number of lines per se coming out of the magnet, we'll say the north side, and coming back to the south side. You put mu metal nearby, you're drastically changing where they flow, but there's still the same number flowing. Isn't that roughly true, K2LAW?
Right on. The loop is always the same. So whatever's coming out of the north end goes around and comes back to the south end. And all that's happening was when it hits permeability, something of high permeability that is tangent to those lines of flux, what will happen is they'll recombine, become tightened, and follow that wall, and then they come back around the other way. So that's why a lot of times for mu metal to work properly, its positioning is everything. So you could have a wall with mu metal, and then you reposition the machine, it may not be as effective as you do like you.
Now, in the case of the superconducting magnets that are doing that yeoman service on the Large Hadron Collider, those coils of superconducting material, I think, have something like 5,000 amperes flowing through them. And those coils are a completely closed circuit with 5,000 amperes flowing, and they're in a cryogenic environment. However, how did you start that current in the first place? In a completely closed circle that's a short circuit, I am guessing by some means you pulse current into it right at the threshold where it's hitting superconductivity. You're cooling it down, and so it's got a little bit of play, so to speak. And if you pulse current into it, you're putting in pulses for very brief periods, but the magnetic coil is storing that, and the superconductivity is making sure that it doesn't lose it. I mean, how do you step up that current from zero in a superconducting magnet? I mean, if it was starting off superconducting, it's not going to allow any change to take place. So how do you put the current into that coil? If you happen to know, over to you, Alan. I mean, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, see, what's interesting about that type of arrangement is that if you create a magnetic loop, and the loop is extremely low DC resistance, and you have a relatively high amount of charge, like if you store a tremendous amount of charge in a capacitor, you dump it into, you know, close a big switch, and you dump that pulse of energy directly in there, you will eventually have enough power to basically overcome anything. So you apply enough power, and you can always bypass whatever you need to get past. So it's a huge amount of power, but that's how it's done. If you don't have enough voltage, you increase the voltage. If you don't have enough charge and current, you increase it. But eventually you will get past to the point to where you get the party started.
Okay, I've got this coil of wire. For simplicity, let's assume it consists of one turn. I mean, it's a whole lot of turns. It's got one turn, and I want the current to flow in that wire clockwise. It's a completely closed loop, and I want the current to flow clockwise, and I'm in the process of bringing that coil down to a cryogenic temperature where it's about to become superconducting, and I've got this charged capacitor in my hand with two leads coming out of it. I don't want to open up that one-turn loop that's going to be superconducting. I don't want to put a relay in there because the difficulty of making a contactor superconductor, I don't want to get into that. So I get this completely closed loop of wire. I want the current to flow clockwise, and I got a charge capacitor in my hand. What do I do next? Over to you, out, Glenn, K2LIW.
Well, you could basically take a transformer and a diode. have a diode that can handle the current and the power that you're talking about, and you have a coupled winding, and you inject the energy into one side of the transformer. So you slam that energy, that charge, into that winding. It couples to the other side, and the diode tells it the direction.
Okay, I think you're telling me that the coil of wire that's going to be the superconducting magnet, that's going to be cryogenically cooled, I've got another coil of wire that temporarily I put my charge capacitor across it. It magnetically couples to the superconducting coil, which is not yet fully superconducting. So I keep pulsing the primary, where the secondary is the superconducting wire. That's what I think you're telling me, and now that makes some sense, because I don't want to interrupt that loop of the superconducting wire. I don't want to open that loop. It's down to micro-ohms. I want to leave it alone. So by another winding, I'm injecting current into the superconducting loop. Is that what you're saying, Alan? And is that the procedure by which you charge up an MRI machine? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
It's the principle, but not necessarily the method. Certainly in the collider circuits, that's pretty much how it's done. In other words, what you're going to do is you're trying to get the resistance of that coil as low as humanly possible. You're always going to have the loss in the diode, and you have the transformer. And pretty much what you're going to do is you're going to keep on pumping the energy into that primary winding of the transformer. It couples to the secondary, and you can have a transformer winding ratio so that you don't have to have as high a primary current. In other words, you can use higher voltage at lower currents to drive extremely high currents at lower voltages on the other side. Where you only have to do is just get past the resistance drop of the diode, and you just pump the energy right in there. And if the energy starts dropping, you can pump a little bit more back in. And the other thing, too, is that if you have a series of these running along, you can synchronize them. So as you build up one, you hit the one next to it, and you can control the delay between each super magnet running down a path. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm convinced that there's a huge amount of magic in magnets. I'm convinced that the vast majority of what we call an electromagnetic wave is primarily magnetism, and there's very little E field there until it comes into the vicinity of a conductor. And then by Faraday's law, the changing rate of change of magnetic field induces a voltage into your conductor, which you call dipole, we'll say. And now you think there was an E field there to begin with. I'm a little skeptical of that, but I'll admit that's a controversial area. I know we've gone pretty far left of field of the original question, John, but still I think we've gotten into
it. Can I have one too, Dick?
Go ahead.
Am I still making it to the repeater, Dick?
You're sounding good. Go right ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think the original question was something along the lines of, what effect does a electromagnetic field, a static electromagnetic field, have on an electromagnetic wave? And the issue is, generally, not a whole heck of a lot. But now here's where the trick comes in. Remember, like we were talking about the mu metal before? Well, what if we just leave the electromagnetic lines of static flux in the air, and there's a spacing between them. And we know what the geometry or the spacing between each, for a given level of H in an area, we know what the spacing distance is between those along a certain curve or area of that electromagnetic line of flux. If we focus our electromagnetic wave between those lines of flux, what will eventually happen is you'll have the spacing for a frequency. So what will happen is the minute that electromagnetic wave starts bumping into those lines of flux, because the geometry of the line of flux is equal to the wavelength of the electromagnetic wave, you'll get an attenuation. And this is basically how it works. So the effect is you do get an attenuation when an electromagnetic wave hits the geometry of the electromagnetic lines of flux returning from a static source. KC2QIQ.
Yeah. And you're now discussing what happens with mu metal in a TEM wave, we'll say. And so TEM waves really ignore a steady state magnetic field. However, the TEM wave is flowing through a medium, ferrite, mu metal, whatever. Now, as you change the biasing magnetic field on that, you get all kinds of crazy effects. You're really using your material, mu metal, ferrite, or whatever, as a kind of metamaterial. It's got some peculiar characteristics on the wave moving from left to right, right to left, clockwise, counterclockwise, and circular polarization, and so on. You can get some really crazy selectivity, somewhat predictable performance if you understand what's going on. So it's the medium that's being biased with the magnetic field that changes the way the TEM wave behaves in that vicinity. That's my understanding. Did you have another one that we should handle, John, or do you think we should go on to the space report? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the second end.
KC2WGB. No, I think we should go to the space net. It's 20 after, almost 20 after 11. Getting short. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Okay, I hope all this jazz doesn't put you to sleep, Paul. WS2N. I'm not going to ask the question, you know. I'm always thinking that one. What's Voyager doing this week? Poor old Voyager is 35 years downrange, and I make it sound like each week it's doing something new. WS2N, K2LIW, and I think it's space report number 139, if I got the records correct. You got it, Paul.
Hey, Dick, did you ever think of how much it costs to send Voyager out there? What do we get per mile? That's a good way to look at it. Over to you.
Yeah, miles per gallon, or when it comes to watts per mile. Oh, boy, that is definitely the record setter. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. I would imagine it's out there so many years that the cost, you're going to have to figure what it would cost 37 years ago. Do the same thing. You got to figure for inflation. In a couple of weeks, the Voyager 1 should be up to 138 AU. Wow. Well, this WS2, WS2N for the space report. TechNet, 139, and, well, since I've been keeping record on the computers, yeah, that's what we're up to. I wanted to talk about the SMAP mission, SMAP, one that went up at the end of last year. We kept track of that. That's the one that had the 20-foot diameter dish antenna. And when it gets up to a position, it was going to open it up to to the full size, roughly 21 feet diameter. And they did that, and it successfully opened, and now in about another month they'll start spinning it at 5 revolutions per minute. That's what I want to see. I want to see this thing, see how it spins without wobbling. But all looks good on that mission. That's the one that's going to detect all the moisture up to a couple inches below the soil, around the whole globe, a couple times a week, complete analysis. Interesting setup. There's a new Mars mission that they're planning on sending to Mars. Don't have a name for it yet. In fact, they don't have funding for it. But based on the success of all these rockets that have been going up lately with ion engines, they plan on sending one up in 2022. That'll be a communication type of satellite. What's happening is all the ones that are at Mars now, the orbiting spacecraft, they're getting older. Some have been up there for many, many years. They're still operating. Mars Global Surveyor, got Mars Odyssey, you've got the European satellite called Mars Express, and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. They're all basically getting older. They need to replace communication satellites to have them in place for future robotic missions and even manned missions in the future. So they thought by sending up another satellite with the ion engines, that they could be more versatile. They could change the height of the orbit. They could bring it in low for scientific work, or you can bring it back out to a height of around 11,000 miles. 11,000 miles is similar to the 23,000 miles that we use here on Earth for our satellites. Send it over the equator, geosynchronous orbit. For Mars, it's 11,000 miles, not 23,000 miles. So it would be a great situation for communication satellites to be at that elevation. But it's all based on the idea that every one of these ion engines that they put up there so far are working perfectly. And what I'm just thinking about now that they've been interested in is the Dawn spacecraft. Dawn has just gone into orbit around Ceres. This is after being launched in 2007. It went to Vista first for a year and a half, and then left orbit, and now went into orbit around Ceres. They're calling it a dwarf planet now. They get the definition of what Ceres is. They seem to change the name to a dwarf planet instead of an asteroid. I still call it an asteroid, but they want to call Ceres and Pluto really the same thing, dwarf planets. In any case, we'll be investigating Pluto as well. We have New Horizons arriving in a couple of months. Mid-July, you're going to have New Horizons come within around 7,000 miles of the surface of Pluto. That one's not going to go into orbit, but you're going to get a good idea of what's going on there. So that's pretty much it for those topics.
Check for Paul, Dick.
We don't have that much more, Dick. You've got couple of flights that are coming up on the 28th of March. Scott Kelly will be going up to the International Space Station, launched from Soyuz rocket. They'll have two crewmen going up with them. We'll be staying for 1 year. So they're getting ready for a long duration mission. We'll see how he does. They'll bring him back in March of 2016. So, we'll see how Mark Kelly does. His partner, one of the Russians, is also going to be staying up there 1 year with him. That's it, Dick. You've got a launch coming up in at the end of the month from Hawaii. That would be the first orbital mission from that state. They've launched other rockets from Hawaii before, but never anything in orbit. They can send up to 500 pounds, 500 pound payload from Hawaii, only small rockets. Interesting rocket that's going to be going up on a Stripe launch vehicle, which is set up on a track type of launch setup. It's in one picture of it. That's pretty much it, Dick. Say if anybody wants to contact me, reach me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Dick, over to you for any questions or comments or what have you. K2RIWWS2N.
Yeah, John has a question for you, and so do I. KC2WGB, go right ahead, John.
WGB. Very good, Dick. Paul, maybe you could give us some more information on what's happening with the photographic mission to Pluto. Have they taken any pictures yet? Do we see anything happening there? Do you have anything new for us? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, that's the New Horizon mission. 10-year journey to get there, and that will be arriving. I believe the closest point to Pluto would be July 14th. That would be about 7,000 miles above the surface. So, they'll be checking out the five different moons of Pluto. pictures of all of that. And right now they've taken pictures of Pluto, but it's still too far away to compete with the existing pictures that we have. But it's coming up there quick now. You won't see high resolution pictures or anything that will beat the Hubble probably maybe around end of April, May. You'll start to see higher resolution pictures than what you have now from the Hubble. Back to you, Dick.
It's going to be interesting because I think Hubble, looking at Pluto, which is a darn far away, I guess something like 39 astronomical units, really is a fuzzy dot with not very much detail. Guaranteed there'll be some surprises when we get the close-up pictures with New Horizon. In the case of Dawn being slowly captured by the dwarf planet / asteroid named Ceres, that capturing procedure was very nicely described. I think it went on for at least a half hour presentation on NPR on Friday, so-called Science Friday. I didn't catch the beginning of it. I didn't know what was going to be on. Happened to be in my automobile and caught it. So I think there's ways you can go to NPR, their website, and play back. Let me drop. Play back past programs. So this female scientist, who is one of the principal investigators of Dawn, was describing the operation of the ion engine and the way it slowly got captured by Ceres. So there could be some other information there that was part of an NPR program that is different than what we've read up till now. So I'm going to try to find a way to play back. As I said, I only heard approximately the second half of Science Friday last Friday, and the major subject of discussion was the Dawn spacecraft. I wonder if you had heard about that up till now, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, I listened from around 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock and I missed the first hour. So, and it was NPR. Ira Flato, he does a great job. So I know what the spacecraft itself has been slowing down for months now with the ion engine. And it'll be into a very high orbit, roughly 12,000 miles or so, down to around 4,000 miles. And eventually, with the ion engine getting lower and lower over time, and in about a month from now, it'll be really taking pictures and using the instruments on board to send back information. I think it's roughly about a month before they start doing that. But officially, they are in orbit now around Ceres. As time goes on, as months go on, in fact, up until around another year or 14 months, Dawn will be operating and constantly getting lower and lower to Ceres. Maybe they'll find out what those shiny spots are. There's two of them now. Everyone reports that it might be a reflection of ice from the sun. They really won't know until they, it'll get in a little bit closer. Dick, over you.
As long as you've got enough fuel for the ion engine, you can circularize your orbit around Ceres and slowly spiral in lower and lower. Have they told us how low they intend to go? You're going to get higher and higher resolution of Ceres. And so, in theory, you could go right down. I was going to say landing, but no, you can't. not unless Ceres is rotating real rapidly. And also, what is the rotational rate of Ceres? Could it be in the vicinity of one rotation for 24 hours? Over you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, every 9 hours. That's the rotational period. And yeah, they're going to go in lower and lower. There's 54 pounds of xenon fuel left. And that will last them for another year and a half, maybe. So eventually going closer and closer. But they're eventually going to stop. I don't know. There's no plans of landing or crashing into the asteroid. You know, they have a lot of different tests, instruments on board. They want to see how much water is involved. There's a lot of water, ice involved in that place. So it'll be interesting science coming back from that. But the engineering to do this, it's supposed to be equivalent to, 1,000 more times than what you could do with a chemical engine. You know, if you had a chemical engine, you would not be able to orbit Vista and then actually leave that orbit to what you're doing now because of the capability of the ion engine. Like, you want to use that for the Mars flight in 2022. They could even use it for sample return missions. You know, you could put up a satellite in orbit around Mars, and especially have a lander go down, pick up material. By the way, that's part of the 2020 program with the rover that's going to be going there. A planned rover similar to Curiosity that will be landing on Mars in 2020, and it'll store samples on board for another future mission. It's not even conceived of yet. That will eventually land on a planet, you know, years from now, maybe 2026 or something, and eventually take those samples from the 2020 rover and launch them to orbit. And eventually send them over to dock with another satellite that has ion engines, and then use the ion engines to increase your orbit over time to break free from the Mars gravity well and bring home a sample return from Mars. Dick, over to you.
Now, Dawn has 54 pounds of xenon fuel left. That's giving them, I think you said, a year and a half of thrust capability. They can spiral down, if they wanted to in theory, a very low altitude over Ceres. But you got to be a little bit careful with that, because the way central force motion of something in orbit works, the lower you orbit, the faster you got to be moving. So eventually you're moving so fast that the pictures you take are a blur. So there's a law of diminishing returns there. Once per 9 hours, I think you told me, Ceres rotates. So it's a slightly short day, so to speak. I'm not sure, but I think the diameter is something of the equivalent of the size of Texas, the state of Texas. I vaguely remember. I may have that one wrong. And I think you're telling us that there is no, right now, anticipated mission of spiral in the Ceres, make measurements, then spiral out and go anywhere else. I think Ceres is the end of the project, but because it's powered by solar panels and it's got a year and a half of gas, there's lots of different altitudes and different kinds of measurements that can be made for a long period of time. Has anyone talked about the end of life of Dawn? And let me drop. Is there enough instrumentation on board of Dawn where it stands a chance of measuring organic materials on Ceres? Can it look at the spectral signature of amino acids or things like that? Can it possibly find out if there's any organic material? Because, as you know, there's a big question about how many of the asteroids, comets, and other things that crashed into the Earth, how many of them contained water and organic materials? So, diameter of Ceres, are they ever going to go anywhere else? Is it going to stay there? What's end of life? Could it go on for another 5 years of continuous measurements? It's going to be exciting to find out what those bright spots are. So, any of the above, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
A lot of these spacecraft have, you know, like neutron spectrometers, you know, they'll look for elements, what the surface is, based on, you know, what the sun is constantly streaming out photons and electrons hitting the ground and bounces off the ground surface. They have these neutron detectors, alpha and neutron types of detectors, similar to what they had even back in 97 on the Pathfinder mission, Mars. You know, they'll be able to tell what kind of minerals are involved and maybe the percentage of it. As far as looking for organics, I don't think so. I didn't hear anything about that. Yeah, end of life mission for Dawn, that's it. It doesn't have enough fuel to break orbit and go anywhere else. Not enough as far as that goes. First time they've been able to go into orbit around one body, break free of that, go into orbit around another. Of course, this terrific effect of the ion engines, they can do that. But it takes a long time to accelerate. Ion engines, they take takes something like 60. They go to change 60 miles an hour. It takes days, you know, 4 or 5 days or something. Change speed. But, you know, you keep that up for, you know, year in, out, you know, year in, year out. Like, you know, I think I've read...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'll repeat that. It has about 24,000 miles per hour change, total change from all the different maneuvers since launch. You never get that with the same amount of fuel for, you know, probably started off with 1,000 pounds of xenon or something. Very highly efficient. I'm very happy with these things. 10, 15 years ago, these ion engines were experimental. Out of using them on a regular basis. Started off with a smart spacecraft. Our European Space Agency, they tested it. And then we had another one called Deep Space One that we tested an ion engine with. And now they're putting them on regular satellites. In fact, SpaceX just launched two spacecraft to geosynchronous orbit, and they had ion engines on both those spacecraft. That's going to help them to eventually get into geosynchronous orbit much cheaper than chemical fuels. Might take them, you know, a couple of months to do it, where chemical fuels might do it, you know, in a week or something, but if you're not in a rush, you know, 4 or 5 months, they don't care. Well worth it. You could launch, you know, a heavier payload instead of using it up on fuel. That fuel could be, you know, added to the spacecraft for you know, bigger batteries or something, bigger solar panels. One other quick thing I want to mention, tests by NASA, I think at the end of the month, over in Utah, they're going to test out the Space Launch System booster rocket. You know, it's going to be two booster rockets on the Space Launch System eventually. That's going to be built for the Orion spacecraft. They're going to test the booster rocket that's being built, about 12 foot in diameter. I think it's 220 foot long booster. And they're going to fire it for a couple of minutes out in the out in Utah. And in fact, NASA's going to televise it. It's a bigger booster engine, very similar to what was on the space shuttle that they used, except this is a little bit bigger. Dick, over to you. This is WS2N.
Yeah, what is the approximate diameter of Dawn? I think you're saying you're not sure that they have the right instrumentation to be able to measure if it contains organic materials, water, and whatever. Run that by again if it can even detect water. But there's another question I had. What was it? Oh, yeah. I think you said that the ion engine gives you 1,000 times more performance than a chemical engine. And so what any thrusting engine does, which it provides a certain number of newtons, pounds, ounces, quarter, whatever you like, pounds of force for a certain length of time. It's the integration of force and time called specific impulse, which is the real performance of an ion engine or a chemical engine. So when you say it's 1,000 times better, I think you might be right. And I think the basis of comparison, if I took a pound of fuel for a chemical thruster, and I took a pound of fuel for an ionic thruster, because the escape velocity, the exhaust velocity is 1,000 times greater, I'm getting 1,000 times more performance out of the ion engine. I think it's roughly what we're saying. You're gonna correct me on that. Your solar cells are giving you the electric power that runs the ionic engine. I think Dawn might contain more than one ionic engine. I think you told me a week or two ago that they flip back and forth between the two. I wonder if you need a whole lot of thrust in a hurry to get into orbit around Ceres. Let me drop it. If you had enough energy stored in batteries as well as collecting it from the solar panels to get into orbit as opposed to flying by, maybe you could blast both ionic engines at the same time for a brief period. So, do I have that right, that the same number of pounds of fuel gives you a 1,000 times more foot-pound seconds, so to speak? Over to you, Wes. Here we go. Paul, WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, that's where I got it from, some kind of impulse chart. And a specific impulse was like 1,000 times different than what you would see on a chemical thruster. Yeah, three ion engines on Dawn. Where you go back to Deep Space One, I think that was the name of that one. And that had one engine that was a proof of concept mission. So that, yeah, this one has three, but they never fire at the same time. They probably would like to. I think you get out in the asteroid belt probably 2,000 watts of energy with the solar cell. You probably need 90% of that to run the ion engine. So you don't have enough solar panels or power to run more than one engine. So only one engine is ever run at a time. They just alternate. I would assume they're giving one a rest. You know, they run for years at a time, and then they'll switch to another one. So yeah, there's three ion engines on Dawn. You asked a question before about the diameter of Ceres. Yeah, it's 590 miles diameter. You're right in there, respect to the size of Texas. Drop it. But I think in round numbers, it's easy to remember the relationship between different sizes. The first asteroid that Dawn went into orbit was Vista, and that's roughly about 300 miles in diameter. So I consider Ceres 600 miles, so it's like twice the size, twice the diameter of Vista. And if you double the size of Ceres, and that'll give you roughly an idea of what the size of Pluto is. Easy for many to remember it that way. So that's the size of the diameter. As far as detecting water, I'm not sure the detection, but you know what equipment is on board for detecting stuff, except for cameras and neutron spectrometers. What else they got, I really don't know. Back to the WS1.
Good stuff. So roughly 2,000 watts is what I think you're saying you're getting on solar panels, and a high percentage of that goes to the ion engine. And are the three engines there for reliability? The three engines cannot be co-located, Paul. So if I use engine number one versus engine number two, aren't I creating thrust in a slightly different direction that's going to make the spacecraft roll? And maybe not. Let's see now. If the ionic engine is gimbaled, then no matter where it is compared to the center of mass, if I got enough swing capability on the gimbal, I can always make it a smooth thrusting without creating a tumbling of the spacecraft. Do I have that right? And so, three for reliability, or is there something good about trading one off? I mean, if you give an engine some rest, does it come back to some higher performance after some rest? It's got to sleep so it doesn't get tired. WS2N, KQLAW.
I know they've run these things, you know, for 5-10 years, you know, straight in the test stand, you know. They just keep going. There's one going like over 10 years now or something. But I would assume they're giving one, you know, a break. I saw pictures of it. They all look like they're sticking out of that one. The boxy unit, going really like a boxy type of spacecraft. And you've got these two large solar panels sticking out, you know. Find that in the center of it on his engine. So, change in a direction. You want to start slowing the spacecraft down. They just rotate the spacecraft. They have momentum wheels inside the spacecraft. They can do that. And they might even have a nitrogen thrust into it. Maybe some kind of chemical thrust on board. I don't know, to change the attitude of the spacecraft. As far as I know, they don't have to gimbal the engines. But I'd like to see bigger solar panels or take a spacecraft and run a whole bunch of RTGs, set that, like 10 of them, make it work. You know, radioisotope thermoelectric generators. That would be great. Put about 10 or 20 of them things on board and see how fast you can get something to Pluto. Back to you there.
Comment, Dick?
You got it, John.
Dick, do you think it's possible, being that they're only using one engine at a time, maybe they're mounted on a carousel, which brings it around to the center, and they can just rotate it, something like that? Back to you.
I'm worried about the fact that if the engines are not gimbaled, and maybe one of the engines is thrusting right through the center of mass, but you can't collocate the engines. You can't put them all in a row. You don't want the back of one engine looking at the front of another one. So therefore, they got to be displaced left and right, so to speak, or forward and back. Left and right, let's call it that. As such, if I go from the center engine to a side engine, that engine wasn't gimbaled, it's going to create a rotation when you use it, because it's off to one side of the center of mass and its direction of thrusting. I think they got to be gimbaled, though, Paul. Got to be gimbaled so you can do some steering. Got to be gimbaled so that you don't create tumbling by the thrusting action. And by the way, when you put an engine, an ionic engine, on test stand for years, let me drop them. The ionic engine only works in a vacuum. So you've got this ionic engine in a vacuum chamber, thrusting for years on end. Okay, your chamber's got a nice hard vacuum, and you're violating that vacuum by pouring xenon gas into it at high velocity, which is bouncing off the wall. So you got to be continuously vacuuming out the xenon gas that's coming from the thrusting of the ionic engine, and you got to worry about where the stuff bounces after it bounces off the wall. So doing a long-term test of an ionic engine on Earth, that's got a bunch of degrees of difficulty there, Paul. The words won't roll off the tongue real easily, but really doing it requires some pretty fancy resources, as I see it. WS2N, K2LAW.
I guess they got a bunch of money to do that, but I know where. I mean, that's how they test. I guess they're pouring a bunch of money into running a big vacuum. High efficiency vacuum pumps hooked up to this thing, I guess. I don't know, I've never seen how that works. You know, you just see close up pictures of this blue light that's coming out of the back of the engine. It's got that blue glow to it. Interesting look. It must be the ionization of a xenon gas or something that creates a bluish look. I don't know, we'll have to research the gimbaling. Try to get some more close-ups of Dawn. I find when you look for detail, night of these certain topics on the internet. I always get so far and then that's it. Now it's like they just I don't know if you've ever gone through that. You get down to researching something and sometimes you get to a point where you have to put a code in like you work there. Back to you, Dick.
Oh, I've run into that. And also, some of these sites will only give you the information. That they give you a real tease. Hey, this guy got this great piece of information. Just go to this, just click on this number here. Click on this square. And as soon as you click on that square, it wants you to give them your address, your email address, your phone number. They want a whole lot of stuff. And I'm guessing they're doing that for advertising reasons. Well, I don't know about you, but I get a hell of a lot more emails than I want right now. I'm slowly getting very reluctant about giving out my email address or any other information. Not because I'm trying to remain anonymous, but I don't like my inbox being filled up with page after page of stuff every day when I check on how many emails I've got. Maybe you don't have that problem. How do you solve that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, I go away and I start looking for different websites. No, I'm not going to start it with all the personal information. That's a big mistake, I think. But I mean, even with JPL, you know, when you get down to fine details, you know, you have to put in a certain number or something. You think with that, you know, it's all government funded. You know, you'd be able to get down to the finest detail. But I do find when you do research something, you tend to wind up on these PDF files. You get a lot of detail from that. Some of them are so hard to read. You know, you really have to be almost work for the place to understand what some of these PDF files I've come across. It's interesting researching things. Now with the Marshall interest, I tried to research the new launch facility they're building down in Texas with SpaceX. Again, it's almost you have to work, almost like you have to work with SpaceX to get some of these pictures in detail. Details about the launch facility. They'll be coming online in about a year. I mean, you're pretty good to find out about the Dragonfly mission that also comes out of McGregor, Texas. That's another launch facility that SpaceX uses. You don't find much information about Dragonfly, almost like it doesn't exist. That's a test vehicle that they're going to be using to see how especially the Dragon with a crew on board will operate in propulsive landing situations. They're going to be testing a craft out in McGregor, Texas. To get any kind of detail on it, you couldn't do it. Eventually, I wound up with an EPA report from the government, and that's, it's like a Freedom of Information type of thing, you know, and really detailed information, not from SpaceX, from the government. Back to you.
A minute, Dick. Maybe yes, maybe no. The machine may not know about daylight saving time. But just in case, I better give the final reports anyhow. This was TechNet number 1546 of the group 32 years ago that started in September of 1982. We'll be back next week if everybody stays healthy. And a lot more spacecraft are going to be launched. I'm really looking forward to the James Webb Space Telescope, that infrared job, which is going to have a lot more capability than Hubble and look at infrared, where you look through dust clouds and watch stars forming and planets forming. I guarantee we're going to see things we don't expect. As we get close to Cirrus, we're going to get close-up pictures that are going to show things that we don't expect. Guarantee Pluto is going to show things we don't expect as New Horizons get there. So we have to eat our vegetables and stay healthy to watch all these spacecraft to make sure we don't miss out and die too soon, Paul. I mean, John. And some of the projects I'm on, like I want to build this rock crusher of an antenna. I got to make sure I stay healthy long enough to complete that crazy project. Be kind to QIQ. Okay, be kind to each other, you guys. Glenn wants to say something. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just wanted to offer you a riddle, Dick, before you go. Because something that pretty much apropos to what we were talking about tonight is if you had a bar of iron and you had a TEM wave where you could adjust the frequency up and down and pretty much whatever amplitude you wanted to and whatever frequency that you wanted to, the riddle is, can you build up a magnetic field on that magnet, then make it a magnet? It was just a bare piece of iron, and you have a TEM field, you know, just a radio wave, and you focused it near that piece of metal, and you could adjust the frequency and the amplitude. The riddle for you is, next week is, can you charge the magnet? Can you actually build up a magnetic field on it? KC2QIQ.
So you want me to create a north and a south pole on this bar of magnetic material, which is unmagnetized, using nothing but a transverse electromagnetic wave, and I guess I'm allowed to make the wave big enough that I create some saturation characteristics. The saturation characteristics tend to be, equal on the negative half wave and the positive half wave. And you want me to accumulate a particular polarity of magnetic charge on the bar. Okay. How about if I rotate the bar at the carrier rate, so the bar thinks that this AC magnetic field is pulsating DC. Am I allowed to do that, Paul? John? Here we go. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2IW.
Nope, you're not allowed to move the magnet. All you have is free space and an antenna, and the only things that you can really change is the polarization, a fixed polarization of the antenna, and you can adjust the power, and you can adjust the frequency. Now, the riddle for you is, do you think you can? You don't have to answer me right away. Just think about it for a while. Can you actually charge a magnet? Can you actually bring up the magnetic field fixed? And with a TEM wave, some vacuum, a single antenna, and a bar of steel. KC2QIQ.
Dick?
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's going to keep us going a while. But John's got the solution. KC2WGB, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
Well, if we have enough power, how about if we just pulse it for that duration? It's only going to apply one of the fields.
No pulsing allowed.
Yeah, you're trying to pulse at a rate that's equal to half the cycle in order to polarize the bar. That's tough. Now, the fastest pulsing I've ever worked on, I did manage to generate high power pulses, kilowatt-like pulses, that were a quarter of a nanosecond long, 250 picoseconds per pulse, which is three cycles at 10 gigs. So each pulse was a 10 gig signal, three cycles of it. On top of that, it wasn't a rectangular pulse, it was a triangular pulse. In other words, it had a slope up and a slope down. Three cycles, sloping up and sloping down in amplitude, and a million of those pulses per second, each one of a quarter of a nanosecond long. You got to think fast. And you cannot build a receiver that can receive pulses that fast. And the answer, you receive that waveform. Let me drop it.
Hey, Dick, forget about turning it on. What if it's raining and you turn it off and catch it at the right point?
Isn't that, turning it on or turning it off precisely, isn't that essentially pulsing? And so let's see if Glenn is allowing that. Run by all the things that were allowed.
Well, he didn't turn it off.
Yep. What are we allowed to do? Am I allowed to turn it on in a particular way? Am I allowed to turn it off in a particular way, like John is describing right now? I'm allowed to move the bar, or I got to leave the bar fixed? Am I allowed to move the polarization of the signal I'm transmitting? What am I allowed to change here, Glenn? KC2QIQ, you got a real conundrum here, K2RIW.
You're allowed to fix the magnet, you're allowed to fix the antenna, but you're allowed to fix it in any position you want. And you're allowed to vary the frequency, but once you find the frequency you want, you have to fix it. And once you find the amplitude you want, you have to fix that. So you're allowed to adjust it any way that you want, but then you have to apply the electromagnetic wave, then see if the magnet charges once you have you picked the right direction. And I'll give you a hint. Magnets don't care what voltage is. It doesn't understand what zero is. It doesn't understand what plus minus voltage is. It's, for all intents and purposes, to voltage, the magnet is a short circuit. So that's a good hint. KC2QIQ.
Now, is this a Duncan experiment? In other words, a pure mental experiment? Would you believe somebody has actually done this? Is question number one. And question number two, the bar magnet, I was about to ask you, does it have any saturation characteristics? Well, every permanent magnet is a kind of coercive saturation. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, you're kind of forcing me to give you the answer there, but, okay, I'm going to tell you, yes, it is possible. Okay, yes, and it's done, and it's also determined, it's how you can, by using RF waves and amplitudes of the waves and the polarization of an antenna, is how you can determine the geometry of electromagnetic static fields. KC2QIQ.
And you're making it sound like a radar experiment where I'm measuring a polarimetry of the echo of this bar. So somebody could position the bar for me behind the screen, and in theory I could find out the orientation of the bar by the way it radar echoes to me. But you're not allowed a pulsing. Once I select a frequency, you're not allowed me to switch the frequency. I'm not sure whether or not I'm allowed to use any kind of amplitude modulation. I think the answer is no, because amplitude modulation is really a subset of pulsing. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, realistically, Vic, it's not necessary. Because, as I said, the magnet doesn't care. All that the magnet sees is peak to peak. It doesn't understand what zero is. It doesn't understand what plus is or minus. It doesn't understand voltage and current. It basically just knows its static field. And when you have an electromagnetic wave at a frequency, and it just so happens that those electromagnetic waves are within the geometry of that structure, in other words, as the lines of flux pass around that iron, if you start feeding through a TEM wave through it, basically what's going to happen is it's going to start interfering with that, and basically you're going to start a current through the magnet, and it will, once it develops in one direction, it just continues to go because it doesn't know the difference in voltage. It just sees peak to peak.
Yeah, at first you're making it sound like a standing wave pattern. Ordinarily, you take a AC-like signal, an alternating current signal, whether it be high in frequency or low in frequency, and you expose that to magnetic material. Ordinarily, that does degaussing. In this case, you're asking me to gauss the thing, not degauss it, with an alternating signal. There seems to be a conflict there, Glenn. Go ahead.
That's the riddle. Figure it out. If you think about it long enough, I know you can figure it out, Dick. If you just watch it, what happens, just remember what the geometry is, the distance between the lines of flux and the TEM wave, and think about it for a minute. What actually happens to the magnet? It'll tell you an awful lot about your Yig filters. It'll explain to you exactly what's happening in circulators and everything else. It's amazing stuff. KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, what's your kitty cat's name?
That's Sandy, and she was named before the storm, believe it or not. About 6 months before the storm is when I got her, but she's been with me ever since.
Is she hollering right now that she wants attention, or she wants a midnight snack?
This cat howls all the time. It's like if I don't pay constant attention to her when I'm inside the house, that's what you hear. That's what I hear.
Sounds like affection to me. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, all right. There's the reason for the hurricane. He named the cat Sandy, and we got him. Well, I just want to thank everybody for joining the net tonight, everybody on Echolink, and where else we got him? Echolink and the chat room, yes. And hope we all meet again next week, and we'll get all these problems solved.
You believe that? We'll tell another one. Roughly how many sign-ins did you see on Echolink and or chat room, John? Go ahead.
Only Dave on the chat room. Echolink, we had 8 at one time.
Dave was into APG?
That's correct.
Okay. 73, you all. As I've said already, be kind to each other. And you ain't going to get out of this one alive, so make sure you enjoy it. Find something you enjoy that you got passion to do. Whether it's a bigger antenna or a bigger magnetic field. Bye-bye, you all.
I'm just not going to show up at my funeral. I'm going to fool them.
You're going to be late. You're going to be late even for that event.
That's right. Have fun, Nick. Talk to you soon. KC2WG, be clear.
We're going to call him the late John Beck. There's a pun there somewhere.